should let the next speaker start.
Oh, talk. Good. Very good.
Thomas Thiemann and Luke Quantum Gross.
So I wanted to say something for just for 1 or 2 minutes about this thing that I mentioned at the very last yesterday night, this problem of time. I kind of washed over this topic in 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes, but I want to say this is a severe problem, and people are discussing this for decades very violently in the literature. And there are lots of aspects to it, and one should really look at this in more detail, but I don't have time for it. But there's a very good reference for it, which is Carlo Rovelli's book, Quantum Gravity. It's called, and there you will find a comprehensive discussion and lots of references. Okay, so yesterday we applied the Dirac analysis to general relativity in the ADM formalism, talking about three metrics and extrinsic curvatures, and now we would like to quantize such a system. So I have to tell you how to quantize in a canonical way such a system with constraints. And I will not tell you the most general formulation of this canonical quantization program. But sufficient elements of it so that we can go through, so that we can apply to what we need in loop quantum gravity quantization framework. So, the starting point is that we have a phase space, with some Poisson bracket on it, and to make my life simple, I will assume that this phase space is a cotangent bundle over some configuration manifold. Which just means to say that I can meaningfully talk about canonical pairs, Qs and Ps. And I will also make the assumption that we have gotten rid also of the second class constraints, and we have only first class constraints. CJ. And furthermore, I will require that these CJs, they form a Lie algebra. So we know that an equation of this form must hold because these are first class constraints. But what I mean to say is that this so-called structure functions FJKL, which in general could depend on Q and P, do not depend on Q and P. So this condition is actually violated in the for the constraints that we have in general relativity. And we have to see later in the course of these lectures what we have to do, what we can do about it. And we'll see how this condition comes in later when we.
They are functions or can be distributions?
No, they are functions. So this is the starting point. Now we have to discuss, we have to make a certain choice, namely, which are the good coordinates on the phase space that we want to quantize. And these are the so-called elementary variables, which I will call P. And consider the set of smooth functions on the configuration manifold. And also consider V infinity. C, these are smooth vector fields on C. And now we consider the set, the direct product of these spaces, so a Cartesian product of these spaces, C times V infinity C. So elements of this are going to be pairs. So these are pairs consisting of a function f in C infinity of C and a vector field V. And one can equip this space with a Poisson bracket, which is f comma v, f prime comma v prime is equal to v applied to f prime minus v prime applied to f. So that's a new function. So that's the first entry. The second entry must be a new vector field, and this is just the commutator of v and v prime, where v comma v prime applied to some function f is just v times v prime of f minus v prime of f. And this set of elementary variables is going to be a subset of this Cartesian product. So as I said before, this is not the most general thing you can imagine, but it's sufficient for our purposes. And this choice, so choose some subset of this such that the following conditions hold. First of all, P closes under the Poisson bracket. Secondly, well, I should have said this can in general be complex valued functions, and this can be complex valued vector fields. So P should also be closed with respect to complex conjugation. And thirdly, and this is really the condition that P is a good are good coordinates on this on our phase space, P separates the points. The points of M. So in general, nobody tells you how to choose this P, but you'll generally take a choice such that your life becomes maximally simple. For instance, that the Poisson brackets between the elements of P don't look, look as simple as they can possibly be. So there are some distinguished vector fields which come from momentum functions.
Does that mean separate points?
separate points means that if you have, suppose you have some set, and you have you choose some functions on the set, then to separate the points means that if for every point, that's right. So if x and x prime are points, and if f of x is equal to f prime of f x prime for all f, then x and x prime must be equal. That's right. Oh, so I should have left this. Okay, so for all x and x prime, or given x and x prime in M, f and x equal to f x prime for all f in P implies x is equal to x prime. So there are some distinguished elements in the set of vector fields that come from momentum functions. So let an A in C infinity of C then define V n in C infinity of in the vector fields of C by V n of f is equal to n a df by d q a. And this is equal to, if you think about it, to PA NA, comma F, if you have bottom brackets such that PA, comma QB is equal to the Kronecker delta. One could imagine that one can take simply all functions on phase space and then just look at the algebra that they generate, and they do form a closed algebra and all these conditions are satisfied. But there will be obstructions to quantizing such a large, much larger algebra, as we will see. So this is just the classical starting point. So we have chosen a P which satisfies all these conditions. Now we want to construct a quantum algebra. Which I will denote by A.
Do you also impose the linear structure on P?
Say it again.
Do you also impose the linear structure on P, such as an algebra structure?
So this is a Lie algebra, and we come to it is by construction, it's a Lie algebra. So now we come to a quantum algebra, and abstractly you can define this as follows. So this is going to implement the canonical quantization relations. So we first construct what people call the free tensor algebra. Over the Lie algebra P called T of P. So these are elements. So this is an algebra which is formed by all or as linear combinations or finite linear combinations of elements of the form A1 tensor A2 tensor tensor An, n smaller than infinity but arbitrary, and AK is in P. So finite linear combinations of those. And you take linear combinations, so you have a linear structure. You can multiply this kind of n-fold tensor products of such n elements by just connecting. So if you have A1 tensor, tensor An times B1 tensor, tensor B, M, then this is just the connection of these things. Now you consider the ideal, both-sided ideal, generated by elements of the following form, A tensor B minus B tensor A minus I times H bar. This is where H bar comes in, the Poisson bracket between A and B. So this ideal consists of elements of this form tensored with arbitrary elements of to the right or to the left and linear combinations of those. So whenever you can find an element, so this is what we call the ideal generated by elements of this form. OK, I will write bigger. And what I also forgot to say is that we also have an involution on this algebra, which is A1 tensor and so on, tensor An. Star is supposed to be An bar tensor, tensor A1 bar. Involution. So now, so this ideal that we generate this way, let us call it JP. This is our ideal. And now we take the quotient. And this is the definition of A. So taking the quotient means that you are deleting all possible elements which can be generated from those by multiplying from left and to the right by elements of the algebra and by taking linear combinations. So all these elements are identified with a zero element.
Don't you want this ideal to be a star ideal?
It is a star ideal with respect to this involution.
Will you get this generated and take? OK, then you can take A bar.
Yeah. That's why you have the I here.
So
yeah, that's why you have the I here, exactly. Okay. Now, this looks like abstract nonsense, but it's really what you find usually in textbooks when people write things like there should be an operator A. So which is just a classical object with a hat on it. And you take the commutator between A and B, and you require this to be I times H bar, the Poisson bracket with a hat on top. And also A, D, the operator corresponding to the complex conjugate should be the same as a dagger, the adjoint of the algebra element. I'd like to avoid this notation because this already suggests that we have a representation, namely a realization of the algebra elements as operators on the Hilbert space. I want to separate these two steps. So this is what you usually find in textbooks, but we don't have Hilbert space yet. Just an algebra. Representations are coming in the next step. So what is a representation for me? For me, a representation, pi, is a map from our algebra into generally a subset of the linear operators on some Hilbert space. Satisfying the following axioms, pi of a times pi of b is equal to pi of ab. So this is the multiplicative structure, pi of a dagger. Now this is the adjoint in the Hilbert space. It's equal to pi of a star. And then also we require, of course, compatibility with the linear structure. So if you have complex numbers z, a, and z prime, b, then this should be the same as z pi of a plus z prime pi of b. Moreover, maybe we should write this in the next blackboard.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it possible to talk about adjoining Hilbert space even if we have not defined any inner product?
Hilbert space, by definition, comes with an inner product. So, and I need one more technical thing to require, namely, unless the image of the algebra is actually in a set of bounded operators, in which case all of this is sufficient, unless this is the case, these are the bounded operators on the Hilbert space. So bounded operators are operators which can be defined or make sense on every possible vector in the Hilbert space. This is not the case for unbounded operators and will be typically not the case for this kind of momentum operators that we are talking about. So in this case we assume that there's a domain in the Hilbert space which is dense, meaning that any vector in the Hilbert space can be approximated with respect to the scalar product that is given to us by elements in D. So we assume that there's a dense and invariant set. So that means that if I map D, it means that any element of the algebra maps D to another element in D. This is what I assume. You assume that there's a such dense and invariant subset. So this is what I will need in what follows. A couple of remarks. You may think that why is this guy talking about representations? Usually we have just a Schrödinger representation or something like this, some L2 space of square integrable functions or whatever. The problem is that in infinite dimensional systems, there's no uniqueness theorem anymore. In other words, there's a famous theorem by Stone and von Neumann, which tells you that any irreducible and representation of the canonical commutation relations of quantum mechanics for finitely many degrees of freedom is up to unitary transformations just the usual Schrödinger representation. And then there's one more slight technical condition, which I will not mention right now. And so in other words, taking L2 of R to the N, dnx, is the unique representation space up to unitary equivalence of the canonical commutational relations in quantum mechanics. In quantum field theory, this is no longer the case. There's an uncountably infinite number of unitarily inequivalent representations. For example, just take a very simple case. Take a free scalar field on Minkowski space and take a Fock representation corresponding to some mass of the scalar field. Then you can show this is a consequence of the famous Hux theorem that these representations are not unitarily equivalent. So since all these representations are labeled by a positive real number, namely the mass of the scalar field, you see that there's uncountably infinite number of inequivalent representations. So already in this example, we see that in order to select interesting representations, we need more information. Yep.
Is it an inferent or an ultraviolet?
This has nothing to do with ultraviolet or infrared. This is just.
If I do this in a box.
Oh, I see.
Or I get it or not?
The only thing that is important is that the number of degrees of freedom is still infinite. So if the box makes the system into a finite dimensional system, then this effect disappears. Well, if I can map this thing for you to a set of harmonic oscillators, a finite set of harmonic oscillators. So he's using the box to make the number of degrees of freedom finite. In this case, Stone von Neumann applies.
It's still a field theory.
If it's still a field theory, then.
Why is it finite?
No, if he tries to use the box in order to do this. I don't know what he wants to do, but. as long as the number of degrees of freedom, as long as the number of modes that you have is infinite, then you still.
There is no possibility of taking any limit of any kind. Because once you get the infinite number of degrees of freedom, you won't have uniqueness of representation. So there is no possibility of really enlarging your box up to infinity. In some way.
Yeah, this limit this limit doesn't make sense. Yeah.
So actually, you have simply a finite system, which isn't a quantum field theory as we appear to know.
So the message is, whenever you have infinite number of degrees of freedom, there's this problem of non-uniqueness of representations. So we need more information. Physics has to provide an information. For example, if you come with an action principle which tells you what the mass of the scalar field is, then you fix the representation. So here the criterion is for us is that downsizing the number of representations by requiring that there exist some factor ordering of the constraints such that pi of Cj becomes a self-adjoint operator first condition, and second condition is that pi of Cj, pi of Ck is equal to I times H bar pi of C L Fjk L. Okay. For those of you who don't know what factoring means, so we have talked so far about this algebra of momentum and configuration coordinates, and this extended algebra that that you get by taking products of such operators. Now suppose that somebody gives you the function q times q times p just on normal quantum mechanical normal finite dimensional quantum mechanical system, and you want to quantize this function. You know how to quantize q. Pi of q is just a multiplication operator. Pi of p in the Schrödinger representation is just I times h bar d by dx. But what about this? How do you write this? So one possibility is to write it as p of q times p of p. Another one is p of p, p of q. Another one. This is the so-called symmetric choice. Another one would be 1/2 p of p, p of q plus p of p, q times p of p. This symmetric ordering has the advantage that this operator is formally still symmetric, at least. So the problem here is that q and p times p classically is the same as p times q, and the same as, of course, the average pq plus qp, but quantum mechanically this is no longer the case. So this is what one means by factor ordering problem or ambiguities, and of course these constraint operators or constraint functions are usually not linear functions in q and p, but they are polynomials or worse. Yes. Yeah,
it makes them.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, and of course, I also assume that pi of c j is defined on D, and also densely defined on D, and that pi of c j preserves D. This assumption I do make. And by the way, because of these factor ordering problems, one can show that it's impossible. I mean, that has nothing to do with being smart and finding a suitable representation. One can show that for purely algebraic reasons, it's impossible to quantize every possible functions on a phase space in such a way that all commutation relations mirror exactly the Poisson bracket relations. This is called the Grunewald von Hove theorem. Pardon me? The last statement was that it is impossible for purely algebraic reasons to have a representation of all phase space functions such that without H bar corrections, you can define an operator ordering such that the commutations relations become exactly I times H bar the classical Poisson bracket, or the operator corresponding to the classical Poisson bracket.
First condition should say that P or CI becomes essential self-adjoint operator.
That would be sufficient, yeah. Now,
sorry, is it always possible to find such a representation which accomplish 1, 2, and 3 points?
No, that's not guaranteed.
Don't have any warranty with
that, no, we don't. Okay. Solving the constraints. So naively, what we want is, so we have now operators corresponding to the constraints. And classically, we are only interested in the points of the phase space where Cj is equal to 0 for all j. So quantum mechanically, in the quantum theory, we want something like pi j of c. Pi of Cj psi is equal to 0. So this would be the so-called physical state condition.
For all psi?
No, the physically interesting psi's have to satisfy this condition. These are the so-called gauge invariant vectors in the Hilbert space. The problem with this condition is that this means that psi has to be a common eigenvector, zero eigenvector of these operators. The problem with this is that if at least one of these operators doesn't have zero in its discrete spectrum, then psi cannot be normalizable. So and an eigenvector is always a normalizable function. In other words, solving these constraints in general is maybe possible, but the solutions to these constraints will not be elements of the Hilbert space anymore. I will come to that. So now let me in one stroke answer this question and also solve the constraints. Let me just define xj to be equal to pi of cj. Then because I required that these operators form a nice Lie algebra, let me define a unitary operator, u of t, which is the exponential of I times dj pi of cj. And tj take values in R. Let me assume, suppose that for t1, for some, so it's, I should say we have n constraints for some t1 to tn in some subset d in R to the n, where n could be smaller or equal to infinity if we have infinite number of constraints. Suppose that for some such subset of this space, there exists a bi-invariant measure on the group G, which is the image under this exponential map. So we assume that for some suitable choice of such n tuple of real numbers, these things actually exponentiate to a Lie group. And in infinite dimensional spaces, this is, of course, far from guaranteed to happen. So this is, an assumption.
What do you mean by bi-invariant?
This I will also define now. Yeah, I'm almost done. Maybe almost done.
Are we always guaranteed that this U of T exists?
Pardon me?
Is it always guaranteed that this U of T exists?
For finitely many operators, for sure. This is always a unitary operator.
I think there is a functional calculus for unbounded operators on their commonness.
Ah, you mean, okay. No, he has a good point. I mean, he has a good point.
I think
you
should at least make another
assumption. The assumption is, of course, that pi of the linear span of the pi of Cj is also a self-adjoint operator. Then there's no problem. Okay, so may happen that two self-adjoint operators are defined on dense subsets. However, they have empty intersection. There exist weird examples like that. So he was asking whether I'm assuming that this is such pathological situation can happen or not. And I think by imposing this condition, you can exclude this case.
You can take any combination when you
define
this
key. All the operators are defined on D, so D is a common core for all these operators.
And on this D, you can take linear combinations.
So linear combinations of these operators then will also be self-adjoint. And then it is indeed a unitary operator.
Excuse me, why G of groups? Why G of groups?
Well, the exponential map maps. The exponential map maps this Lie algebra to a group. That's what I'm assuming, to a Lie group. Yes. So, and bi-invariant means that if you have a function f, which maps g to the complex numbers, then d mu of t integrated over t of f times u of t naught u of t is the same as d mu of t of f times u of t naught is the same as d mu of t f of u of t. So in other words, this mu is a Hahn measure. On G. And again, the existence of such measure, existence and uniqueness of such measure is far from guaranteed if the Lie algebra is infinite dimensional. Now, given all these assumptions, we define what people call a rigging map. Rigging map, which is a map from the dense and invariant domain to D star, which are just all linear functionals. Or you can also call them distributions if you want, distributions on D. And the map is given by psi goes to integral D d mu of t u of t psi dot f. And this is just the inner product in the Hilbert space. So I have to tell you how this such distribution acts on an element in D in order to show that it's well defined. So the distribution eta of psi acts on psi prime by filling the slot with psi prime. Now, the point of this is that I can show you that now the image under this rigging map gives us actually solutions to this physical state condition. So let me compute for you. Eta of psi applied to u of t times psi prime is equal to d mu of t prime times u of t psi u of t prime psi prime. Now, because of unitarity, this is the same as d mu of t prime u of minus t prime, maybe the other way around, psi u of t minus t times u of t prime psi prime. Now consider this as f of u to of t to the minus 1 times u of t prime. Now, because of bi-invariance of the measure, this is equal to eta of psi applied to psi prime. Now, this means formally also.
Is it a good moment?
No, it's not a good moment. But I will take 5 minutes longer and take 5 minutes shorter the next lecture. Is that OK? Psi prime. Oh yeah, you are right. So
the prime has to be switched.
Yeah, this has to be switched. Minus minus t prime. So this being the case, if you now differentiate this equation, d by tj of eta of psi of u of t psi prime is equal to 0 because it actually doesn't depend on tj, and I evaluate this at t equal to 0, then you get eta of psi pi of cj psi prime is equal to 0. Now this, if you remember how this is constructed, this means that, and this is now a formal calculation, d mu of t, this is the same as, because of self-adjointness, pi of cj integral d mu t u of t psi comma psi prime is equal to 0 for all psi prime in d, which is dense. Therefore, if you would conclude that, if you assume that this boxed thing is an element in the Hilbert space, then you would conclude that this is a 0 eigenvector. So this is how this generalizes to distributions, what we can't really have if this is not normalizable. Now I show you why it's not normalizable. Or why it's possibly not normalizable. So let me call this capital psi. So suppose we want to compute the norm of capital psi in the Hilbert space. Well, then by definition, we get d mu of t prime, u of t psi, u of t prime psi. But because of bi-invariance, I can get rid of the u of t here. Therefore, we get formally d mu of t, which is just a number now, times u of d mu of t prime, u of t prime, psi prime, psi comma psi. Now, this is the volume of G. And if G is not compact, then this has no chance to converge to something finite. So what to do? What do we do with these solutions? We have to define a new inner product. The new inner product you get by dropping this volume factor. Eta of psi prime. In the physical inner product now, is given by eta of psi prime applied to psi, which is the same as d mu of t, u of t psi prime psi. So you see really that I just drop this additional volume factor here. So this is the physical inner product. So in general, the image of this eta map only gives you a dense subset in this new Hilbert space. So you complete it to get an honest Hilbert space. So I think this is a good way point to stop.